Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. January 16th, 2014. Number of topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about the upcoming Rosetta mission to a comet. And as the decades and years roll by, as these comet probes go out and they anticipate finding a dirty snowball, the charade continues. And of course, this is ongoing. This will not end. But we'll be commenting on that. What they expect to do, they expect to land a probe on a comet nucleus and then drill in to see its properties. So once again, I'll be talking about that. My theme this year, as you know, is positive science, trying to be very positive about creating a new future for us using scientific concepts and getting away from the old paradigm that the universe is static and it's been here for 4.5 billion years ago and nothing happens and there's no electricity out there. I just saw a very interesting set of photos. A listener sent in a link, and it was to a series of weather photos, beautiful, amazing weather photos. And the comment of the listener was clearly that, clouds passing by one another simply cannot create this kind of weather. And the weather patterns, the tremendous weather cloud systems that we're seeing, they're very beautiful, but very stark and very, there's just something about a big storm system that's frightening. You just look at it and you go, wow, there's a lot of power in this. But is the sun, solar light creating this? And of course, the answer is no. The sun, solar light, I start out my weather book by saying that if the solar light energy was all that would come into our atmosphere, we would have very bland weather. It would be very bland weather. We would have hardly any wind. We might have a little bit of a movement of air at the terminator, where the dark side of the Earth and the sun side of the Earth meet. We would have a bit of a vortex motion there in wind, which would kind of carry over between night and day. We would not have any clouds, because the vertical electric field is required just to even create the clouds. We wouldn't have tornadoes. We wouldn't have thunderclouds. We would not have hurricanes. We would not have typhoons. We wouldn't have 300-mile-an-hour wind typhoons. Literally, none of the weather that exists would happen. We would not have jet streams. There are literally 5 jet streams. The 3 that we normally think of, the equatorial jet stream moves in a westerly direction, and it is primarily electrons, and we have 2 northerly jet streams that sometimes couple together. Recently, there was talk about a polar vortex, and a vortex is something that comes together and like a vortice, like it goes down the drain. So it was really a totally improper word to use for the northern jet stream. Sometimes it separates from the primary jet stream in the northern hemisphere. And there are 2 jet streams sometimes, one around the polar region and then one around the mid-latitude regions, and then, of course, the equatorial region, and then that can be the same in the southern hemisphere. But there was a jet stream that was circling around, right around the Arctic Circle, it's kind of snaking north, snaking south, and they called it a vortex. Well, a vortex is like when you pull the plug and the water goes down the drain and it creates a little vortice. That's a vortex. So it was a completely improper use of the term vortex because the jet streams go circular around the world. They go around the globe and reconnect at the other end. They're not really connect. They're just continuous, I should say. And so the term vortex completely inappropriate, but we had two jet streams for a while, and the mid-latitude jet stream would go up, touch onto the Arctic Circle, and then come down and bring all that cold air down into the United States. And this is all driven by electrical solar conditions. Now, so at any rate, let me explain how this works, how the electrical component of the sun drives our weather systems here. And this is all explained in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologica, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, written for the general public. It's kind of a complicated term, but it is the principal textbook on weather, and it's been around for many years. The weather systems, the way I've identified them, this weather work, it's very important for you to understand how this works. That book, by the way, is available both in print form and in electrical ebook form on the webpage. But at any rate, here is briefly how the weather works given the electrical conditions of the sun. So here's the process. Let's start at the sun. The sun puts out an excess current of protons, which creates a solar capacitor out beyond the farthest planets, Pluto. Originally, I thought it was around the planet Jupiter. That's when I started analyzing this back in the 1970s. But we didn't have data. We didn't have satellites that had been out that far. And once the Voyager satellites got out farther and we started analyzing more data, then it became obvious to me that the boundary of the solar wind was way farther, much farther out than Jupiter. And so the Donut Nebula that I talk about in my original papers is obviously out very much farther. And so at any rate, that is the capacitor that Earth is discharging, as with all of the other planets. Okay, so the solar capacitor, the Earth is like the bug in the backyard bug killer, so to speak. The zapper, remember I used that as many times as an example of the discharge of a capacitor by an object. Many people are familiar with the backyard mosquito bug killer. It's two electrical plates, high voltage plates, separated, and it's like a screen so the bug can fly in there. The bug is attracted towards the light in the center, and as it flies through the electrical grid, the discharge occurs right where the bug is every time. And of course, it's a high energy electrical discharge, primarily electrons moving. And there's a reason for the electrons being the primary charge carrier. All of this is explained in my books. But then the energy in the electrical discharge kills the bug falls down, and then the capacitor charges up again, waiting for the next bug to fly in. In the solar system, the planets are all discharging this solar capacitor all the time. So the end result is we have electrical energy passing around Earth at all times. The electron beam coming out from the sun, it's the exact same electrical discharge properties as a comet. And so the Earth, therefore, has water coming in. It has a stream of water coming in constantly from the tail side. And these tend to concentrate in regions of the upper atmosphere that become charged. And so, oddly enough, standard science is measuring these and coming up with all kinds of fairy tale science reasons for why they should exist. That there's dust in the upper atmosphere and that attracts water to that region, and you know, it's just so much fairy tale science that they have to construct so many band-aids on a defunct theory that doesn't work. But my point originally was that NOAA, the National Weather Service, does not account for any of these electrical properties that drive our weather. So at any rate, the electrical connection, we have the electron beam on the sunward side, and these create a current around the Earth which drives a magnetic field. And there are many layers to our magnetic field. I defined these in my weather book. There are actually about five major magnetic field layers, including the Van Allen belts, including the ionospheric currents, including the jet streams that are in the upper atmosphere. And then this is coupled with electrical currents that are actually in the ground. And that's why when, for example, we have a big solar flare, these magnetic couplings are already set up, and they can very quickly drive currents in the ground. And that's what causes the issues like with the Carrington event when we had a magnetic pulse. It's really initiated by electrical currents that are passing by Earth every day. And so the weather systems are driven by these electrical currents, and it's a complex interaction between outer space all the way down to the surface of the Earth. So when we have tornadoes or we have thundercloud systems that are putting out electricity, I find it very interesting that every time we see tornado pictures, we also see a lot of lightning. People that have captured images up in the tunnel of a tornado see lightning continuously in the tornado, in the cone of the tornado. Well, this is all part of an electrical discharge. The tornado is, in fact, the center point of an electrical discharge that extends all the way to ground. And what happens is the air around ground ionizes because of this electrical current. It ionizes and it starts swirling up in a central electrical path, and that's what creates the tornado. That's the visual part of the tornado we see. The National Weather Service would have you believe that a tornado is just swirling wind, and that this happens because clouds happen to brush by one another. It's just so absurd. And how is this maintained? I mean, one might believe that, okay, you could get some swirling air, but how does it concentrate in a cone that extends down from a cloud? There are no clouds around. Many tornadoes come out of a perfectly blue sky. In my weather book, I have a picture of a tornado extending out of the volcano crater of Mount Etna, out of a volcano. Well, the volcanoes are tall mountain peaks. They extend up in the vertical direction, and it's like an electrical finger pointing up its ground potential, extending up into the sky, and can discharge the solar capacitor, especially when dust and gases are extending up out of the crater. And so that helps to the ionized gas in that volcanic plume or in the gases that come out of the volcano extend upwards and help discharge that Earth capacitor up to the ionosphere. So at any rate, without going into a lot more detail, this is what drives our weather. And so the entire concept is that we are electrically driven, and we can capture some of this electrical energy to run our society. My goal in terms of positive science is to encourage the use of natural energy. It's available in two forms. One is in terms of the electrical currents that are coming down from the ionosphere, the direct use of those. The other is in the form of wind. Wind is a direct result of this. So now, in terms of positive science, imagine if it were allowed, if it were allowed for this knowledge to be passed off to the public, for the knowledge of free electrical energy coming from outer space and our ability to tap into it. Remember that the three-blade wind system is a planned failure. It was known from the beginning that the wind systems were terribly inefficient and that they would never in a million years accomplish alternative energy. It's what I call the myth of alternative energy. The three-blade wind generators scattered over the countryside, thousands of them in Nebraska, really, when they talk about what they call the installed base, they talk about the maximum wind generation from all of those wind generators running at peak wind, like 30-mile-an-hour wind, and all of them running at top performance all of the time. The actually, when you've driven through Nebraska or Kansas where all of the wind towers are placed, you see that the vast majority are not even spinning at all. They're not producing any energy. And so that's the point. The point is that they don't want alternative energy, and they invest. They actually put a lot of money into systems that will not work. That's to give false hope. And why shouldn't they? Because you are paying for it. In your electric bill, you're paying for all of those wind towers that are not producing a single drop of energy relative to the need. And so we can capture wind energy in an efficient manner. The other thing is we have to redesign how we store energy. Every house, when you have an energy system that is not constant, you have to store energy in some kind of a unit. So can you imagine cell batteries, like liquid cell batteries, the size of your refrigerator in your house? This would be enough for 2 or 3 days of electricity, and that would act as a buffer. So we would have stored energy in your house, we would have stored energy in your automobile, and we would be living in an electrical society driven by natural energy. No burning of nuclear power, no burning of coal, no burning of oil for automobiles. So the big three energy sources, oil, nuclear, and coal, which burns also, is terribly pollutant and really is a environmental disaster for the land. Look at the tar fields in Canada. There's a big push to harvest all of those. Look at the natural gas that's now coming out of North Dakota. And the one thing, natural gas is a relatively clean energy. I almost have to lean towards natural gas as a positive form of energy that we can use. But still, we are emitting into the atmosphere something that's burning, something that's polluting, and we are using oxygen. It's a myth that the forests are going to restore the oxygen that's being burned by combustible energy sources. It's simply a myth. We have now about 50% of the oxygen that we did 100 years ago in the atmosphere, and it's simply not talked about. You can't continue burning coal, natural gas, and oil as a form of energy, and God knows that nuclear energy is a disaster. The Fukushima nuclear disaster is something that nobody is talking about, polluting and killing the Pacific Ocean. I did a report on that last week. So at any rate, imagine, now let's turn around and talk about positive science. Imagine a world in which we derived our energy sources from a natural source, wind and the vertical electric field. And we tapped into, instead of having powerful tornadoes and hurricanes, we were able to take that energy and store it up in the houses in all across the country and be able to truck this energy along high power voltage lines from, say, the wind is in Arizona today. Well, that's feeding energy up to New York City, and New York City would have its own battery bank of wind generators out in the ocean, where it has a continual daily, nightly, all day, all night, 365 days a year, has wind generation capacity. But with the three-blade wind generator, it simply is not going to happen. I made a calculation once when I was on the Coast to Coast radio show, host George Norrie. I did a radio show special on the myth of alternative energy, and I made a calculation for that show. It was that the world energy needs, we know how much energy the world uses every day, and in the developing worlds, and especially countries that are coming online like China and like India, that the energy requirements of the world, it would take 77 million running at capacity, at the 20% efficiency capacity, 77 million of the 2 megawatt wind generators, the 3-blade wind generators, 77 million to make a dent or to come close to running our world's energy needs. But the problem is, how do you produce 77, how do you produce and install 77 million wind generators? Well, it's absurd, of course. And so what we need are systems. This is something I've been doing in the background. And the systems are now going to be available to come online and produce up to 2 gigawatts of energy per system. This is the kind of efficient energy system we need from naturally occurring energy sources. So imagine a lifestyle in which, number one, energy is literally the cost of maintenance of these systems. Very, very low. Okay, now your hot dog that you buy when you go to a baseball game is not going to be $4, it's going to be 35 cents. Imagine the work environment. We use efficient lighting. We do all a good 20% of all of electricity used today is in the form of electrical lighting. And so just cut that down, cut our usage down. Stop this ridiculous 40-hour-a-week work week concept where you have to run back and forth to work every day. Most people doing literally useless work to drive an economy that is based on loans and phony money. So the cure of this is not simply energy, but you have to understand that energy is the control mechanism for the world. The same people that run the banks own the energy, and that's what drives the prices up. The Chavez from Venezuela said he could provide refined gasoline, all that the United States would ever need, for 50 cents a gallon, and he would be making a boatload of profit. Now, what does this tell you? This tells you that you are living in a monopolized energy world, in which everything that happens, every phone call you make, every gallon of gas that you pump into your car, which requires electrical energy, every gallon of water that you draw out of your faucet, out of your tap water, everything costs energy. Everything is costing energy. That expense is piled on top of everything that happens, multiplied by every factory. And so we have to get away from this idea that you have to buy a car every 3 years, because an electrical car would last you your lifetime. You would buy one car for about $5,000, and that would be it. That would be your car for the rest of your life. And maybe in 10 years or 15 years, you might have to replace the motor and have it rebuilt or recycled, the electric three-phase motor or others, DC motor that would be in your automobile. And the batteries, the battery technology is improving greatly, but still the liquid cell batteries, the acid batteries that we use today in automobiles store a tremendous amount of power. We could easily expand the production of those, and as I said, have a refrigerator size battery in every house with an inverter that drives your electrical system. A lot of components in the house now could be wired as 12 volts LEDs, tremendously efficient lighting. Most of the electric that we use today is literally wasted, plus it's tremendously inefficient to move energy around the way we do today. If you look, I did a study once for a project showing that about 5% of the energy, when you burn a pound of coal and you look at the energy that's produced, about 5% of that energy is actually turned into useful work at the end consumer location. The rest is lost in conversion, in wires, in converting from one voltage to the other. tremendously, tremendously inefficient. And so the other thing we could do is put wind generators locally so that that energy is received and used locally to eliminate much of that transfer of energy in the big systems. But then the other part of this is we wouldn't have to work as hard. The housing costs, just imagine housing costs with low energy, all of the cost that is built into building materials because of the incredible, incredible, absolutely incredible amount of cost simply for energy, for say wood or for building materials, earth building materials like blocks or cement. Just think of all of the energy that goes into that, that is high-priced energy. So a house that's $300,000 to build should be about $40,000 to build, simply when you reduce that energy expense. And so when I talk about positive science, this is what I'm talking about, creating a better world in which we have a lot more free time to enjoy, we have time to enjoy with the people we love, and it is something that's a positive step towards a society that's sustainable. Right now, everybody's running around trying to be like the United States, and the United States is crumbling under its own weight, and an economic model that is not sustainable, that cannot move into the future. So, at any rate, let me move on to a few other topics here. And by the way, first of all, there's announcements, emails going out, web pages. A bunch of Looney Tunes are out there saying that there is a black star of death coming in May of 2014. There is no such thing. Ignore anything like that you see. Also, even NASA is jumping on the bandwagon here, saying that Comet Ison left a trail of meteors. I saw an article by an astronomer from New York saying that there was a fireball that came across. It was seen in New Jersey, New York, and southeastern Canada, up by Ottawa, somewhere in that region, as it streaked across the atmosphere, and they speculated that it came from Comet Ison. Well, it's just so remote. And maybe it did, but the point is, don't say things that are not provable. Don't talk about science that is not provable. And the reality is that all of the predictions of standard science regarding Comet Ison, of a red dust cloud coming into the atmosphere, none of it, absolutely none of it came true. And we're now on the 16th of January, all of those predictions have passed. And of course, as I said before, I made a prediction that if Comet Ison made it around the sun, which it did not, I said we could see some effects around the 11th to 15th of January. And of course, Comet Ison disintegrated after its close passage with the sun, so it was not here to be in an electrical alignment with Jupiter and Venus and Earth. At any rate, the point is that the standard science community is still trying to leverage off of Ison and literally tremendously speculative statements that have no scientific merit at all. Yet they get published, but one of the points of those articles is to promote the dirty snowball comet model. When you read those articles, that's all they do is they promote, I'm losing my voice, they promote the dirty snowball comet model, which of course is, it's imperative for them to keep that going. The paradigm of standard science, it's imperative because all of the things I'm telling you about living positive science, living in a world where we have energy, that one of the biggest hindrances to getting this point across and getting it understood by the public is the demand of standard science, and this is by their handlers, not simply them, but by their handlers, to promote the dirty snowball comet model. In other words, the the idea that comets are little fluffy things out there have nothing to do with, there's no electricity in space, so don't think about getting free electricity. And this maintains the energy monopoly. So at any rate, now you can, I hope you understand fully why this tremendous push, this tremendous need to comply with the Dirty Snowball Comet model. In that sense, NASA is hopeless. So I continue to forge ahead with this program. I do comment on this, and I know a lot of people get really tired of hearing this, but remember, there's a lot of new people listening to this show, and I have to keep putting it into perspective. My audience grows every week by leaps and bounds, and so I have to continue to bring up those people that are just starting out understanding these concepts. I have to keep reaffirming the fact that what they have been taught is complete garbage baloney. Another topic, somewhat of a diversion of a topic, is that what if, I want to, also in terms of positive science, I've talked many times before about the communications industry, something that I know really a lot about. I worked in the communications industry for about 10 years designing communications computers with a company. We built the biggest private communication networks in the world with secure computing, the front-end processor computers that interfaced with the IBM mainframes in the largest computing installations in the world. So it's something I happen to know about. I also worked for about 15 years of my career in the telecommunications industry with the telecommunications corporations that do everything from cell phones to DSL to internet backbones to digital circuitry to high-speed digital trunks, everything to do with that. So it's a business I happen to know a lot about. But what's happening today is that the major carriers, especially the cell carriers, the cell phone carriers, and I don't know anybody that has a landline anymore. That's very rare. But the cell phone companies are blocking progress. Imagine now, a lot of people have Facebook, which I particularly don't. I don't because it's a CIA-owned information gathering entity now, as is Skype. But imagine if you had Skype on Facebook. In other words, all you pulled up was one application. You didn't need Twitter. You didn't need other forms of communication. You pulled up your Skype account, and basically that was you. You had your camera on your cell phone. You have a smartphone. All of your email and your voicemail comes in. It's stored in your very own telephone. But imagine the marriage of Skype with Facebook, an internet telephone service with Facebook. Now you pull up, you've got your data on Facebook, you've got your camera, you've got you, and Skype married into that would be a total communication package for you. And now it's become very weird because the CIA owns all of these. And uses it for information gathering. And when I say the CIA, that includes the NSA and all the other invisible information gathering centers employed by the U.S. government, which is a branch of the basically world government, which already exists through the banking cartel, the international banking cartel. So all of this information gathering is to make sure that those banks are secure and the public does not find out about it and go out and hang them all from the highest yardarm, which is what should happen. Basically, the CIA, the NSA, is an information-gathering agencies, and these are meant to keep the population at bay. If anybody gets out of line, they're immediately cornered and isolated out and become... basically a target, and their lives are destroyed or whatever else might happen to them. But basically, This is to protect the banks from losing their power grip. And that's why, by the way, they are also deathly afraid of comets, because it's those items out there, a big comet, a big, big comet up in the sky, not the little ones we see normally, but a great big comet. They are afraid to death that the public is going to find out what those things really are, because not only would they realize that we could garner the energy from outer space, but that those people in the banks and in the home loan and the insurance industry and in the energy industry have no control over those things out there. And it would give people a new attitude, and that's what they don't want. They don't want you to have a new design attitude on life, that you can live your life free from all of the baloney that's been cast upon you. So imagine a world in which energy is low cost, but also we have communications. And so all you would need is your smartphone, a $30 a month or a $20 a month good internet connection, of which there should be plenty, and Skype with Facebook, and that's your total communication package. You download movies, your internet news, you get your television, movies, communication, all along that $20 a month communication line. So look at what the phone companies do to you. First of all, you pay about $50 or $60 just for the phone line, which you do not need. You do not need that phone line. But they make you pay for that. Now they tack on another $20 or $30. Gee, aren't they great for internet? And then they say, well, do you want voicemail? How about text messaging? Okay, that's another expense. Okay, so you add all this together, and now you put it on the family plan, and you're paying $200-$300 a month to the phone company when it should be a mere $20 or $30 for the whole family. And in your house, why should you have another internet connection? All of your internet should come in on your phone. You take your phone, you lay it down next to your laptop, or your laptop has the same type of technology in it, and voila, there you are. You have your computer. On your computer, it's your phone, it's your identity, everything else. But in a world that's free, not with the government peering into your computer and at your face and everything you say and do. No, a world in which your communication and your vision of you is private. That is your private information. Nobody has a right to dig into it and look into it, peer into what you're doing. So at any rate, that's my view of communication technology. A $20 a month internet connection with all of your communication needs right in that. There's no need for them to charge you more for this. They have this saying, bundle and save. So you're supposed to buy all these services. You don't need all these services. Your smartphone has all the capacity it needs for voicemail, email, communications of any other type, whether you do messaging or Facebook or Twitter or whatever you want to do. All of that is now should be available in your very own smartphone. Talking to anybody in the world, there should be no more long distance charges, because the internet is worldwide. So there should be no more charges, and of course some of these companies, of course, have the right to make money. So you might have additional charge, you know, maybe a few bucks a month for Skype or something like that. But at any rate, in most of these companies, like Facebook, is free. So they make their money off of other ways of making money, the advertisements or whatever. But basically, you should have telecommunications. All your communications needs should come to you over a very inexpensive single internet connection. That's my point. And this few hundred dollars a month for a cell phone service is absurd, but the companies in charge of these, the big major cell phone companies, have blocked this technology from the public. And it's wrong, it's a theft. And someday it's going to break down. But then again, the government is in collusion with all of these. The Federal Communication Commission should have been in charge of this, so that the public had decent communication, to boot, you go to some place in the country and you don't have communications because your company isn't there, or you're roaming, you have to pay more. When the AT&T was broken up, the breakup of the Bell operating system, it was part of the breakup concept that all of these smaller companies that would develop would be communicating together. In other words, you would have a seamless national communication network, and it's nothing like that at all. It's a big, giant mess. And you have very poor communications, and you're paying a tremendous amount of redundancy cost. In other words, the six companies out there all have executive branches. They all have equipment and maintenance staff and finance departments, etc. They all have all of this, and it's all part of the communications redundancy. There are six major companies that have all of this redundant equipment and personnel, and so you're paying six times what you should be paying just for that reason alone. Okay, well, enough of that bandwagon, but someday in a real world with positive science, telecommunications and communications, first of all, would be private. Second of all, it would be very inexpensive, and it would be all-encompassing. All of your information would come over that one very inexpensive line, and it would go with you. It would travel with you. And when you were in some other town or some other country, you could pick up the phone and communicate with somebody just as easy as 1, 2, 3. Okay, on to the next topic. Venus inferior conjunction this past week. I believe it was the 11th of January. And as expected, the sunspot count shot up overnight. We had one of the biggest sunspots, 1944, which was somewhat active, but remember I did some reporting last week that was way over publicized, that the CME that came out of that sunspot was vastly over publicized. And I went on the Coast to Coast radio show. They had me do a solar update. That was my report. But then I said, listen and wait for Venus, the inferior conjunction of Venus, which was on the 11th, a couple nights after I was on Coast to Coast. And and that's exactly what happened. We had a tremendous amount of sunspot activity. The number of sunspots and their sizes grew with the inferior conjunction of Venus. That means that Venus was directly between us and the Sun. And so I explained last week also that there's two electrical connections, one that kind of follows the solar wind, which is a curved path, and one that is very straight. And you see this with comet tails also, that there's the type 1 and type 2 comet tails. The type 1 comet tail is the big broad one that you typically see, and the type 2 tail is a very narrow spike, so to speak, of tail that is directly aligned with the sun, both on the sunward side and the non-sunward side, and that's the electron beam that is the major focus of the electrical discharge with the solar capacitor. Okay, so at any rate, Venus inferior conjunction, and it went from about two sunspots up to about a dozen overnight. So once again, confirming the electrical connection between Venus and Earth and the Sun. And also the fact that external objects energize, so to speak, when that electrical energy is coming out of the Sun, that enhances the fusion that's going on in the Sun, pushes out in the solar wind. And we did see this, an excess of solar flaring activity with the proton blasts that were coming out towards Earth. So prior to the inferior conjunction of Venus, sunspot 1944 did not really have any activity over, although it was way over reported by standard science. But on the 11th, when the inferior conjunction of Venus occurred, it did have an immense impact, not as big as one might expect, because the sun's energy is very much at a low ebb. but it did have a significant increase, enough to make it noteworthy. So at any rate, a major indication that the solar system is electrical, and that the Venus coupling with Earth, or the other planets coupling with Earth, cause major electrical conditions, and these can be reflected in our weather, in winds, and all kinds of other conditions on Earth, weather conditions. Remember also that Comet Isan was not there. It was not there, and so that could have made things quite a bit more interesting. Because at that point, Comet Isan, if it were still around, would have potentially connected into the sulfur dioxide belt around Jupiter, and that's what I predicted. It was on those January dates of about the 11th to the 14th, 2014, just a few days ago. We could have seen potentially a red influx of sulfur dioxide. But that's, of course, why the standard science community ran out and had to make their own little predictions, and none of those came true. It seems like they cannot quite get their act together, or that just chance evolution of events like the disintegration of Isan, and the fact that their predictions were made before the disintegration of Isan, and that the streamers of supposed red dust left Isan before it disintegrated, and the fact that none of that ever came to pass just shows that they were just trying to head me off at the pass, so to speak, with a bunch of their fairy tale science. Last week I talked about draining the lake at Yellowstone, and that is something that is very important. I was on a show with John Moore yesterday morning, and we discussed that further. So at any rate, it's a project, and I have about 10 major Earth projects that I plan to initiate and fulfill. And so this is the most pressing and immediate of these, and so that's in fact underway at this time. We'll put out more details as that progresses. But the fact is that the lake in Yellowstone, if it were to breach and fall down into the magma layer, which we know is below the Yellowstone crater, that could turn into a super volcano, and the only it could all be prevented by draining the water out of that lake and getting it out of there. And that's not a big project. It's not something that even requires electrical pumps, or it's just a very simple process to get the water out of that lake. And like I say, that's a project that's underway, and hopefully we will have progress on that to announce. The last few minutes here, I want to talk about the Rosetta mission to a comet. This is the European Space Agency probe. I believe it was launched in 2004, so this has been a long time coming, and they are just brought the spacecraft out of a sleep mode. It was put to sleep as it was journeying for a rendezvous with a comet, and this around August it's supposed to meet with that comet, and I believe by November of this year, they will actually send a probe down to land on the comet. So they're going to orbit the comet for a while using an orbiter, and take pictures, photographs, examine the surface. And all of this is supposed to happen as the comet comes into its closest approach to the sun. And so they expect to see dirty snowball activity off of this comet nucleus. But the reality is they will probably not see any water leaving the nucleus. And this is not something new. It's not something like we're all holding our breath like this is the first time they went to a comet. They've been to 5 comets close up, close range, and not a single one of them showed production of water off the surface. For example, Comet Bild was a black, tar-covered, very hot object There was no water coming off of it, no steam coming off of it, no water on it, no ice, no snow, a black, tarry surface. And the spectral analysis showed that it was basically hydrocarbons. And that's what one would expect on a burnt nucleus of a comet. A comet nucleus that had an electron beam burning the hydrocarbons onto it over the period of time. Okay, so basically there's nothing new about what Rosetta is going to do or so-called discover. But what they want to do is they want to land on the comet nucleus, and they're going to drill down a few centimeters only. It's not going to be a very deep drilling process. They're going to try and grab onto the nucleus with probes as they go down, because there's no gravitational field significant enough to hold a spacecraft into place. So they have to hope to come down, grab onto the nucleus before this spacecraft bounces back off. And if it bounces back off, I don't know if they have any way to get it back down there to reconnect with the comet nucleus. But their hope is that they can drill into the comet nucleus and discover its composition. They have a spectral analyzer on the comet nucleus, and so that it should be able to determine what kind of materials are in the nucleus. But here is what they will find. In fact, as this comet probe drops down to the surface of the comet and is going to be an active comet, we should expect to see electrical discharge activity as we did with Comet Temple 1 when the deep impact spacecraft went down. And that's something I predicted on the Coast to Coast radio show, a public announcement that I said, yeah, as that probe goes down to Comet Temple 1 to the nucleus, we're going to see a flash electrical discharge because the probe is coming in at a lower potential. And the discharge, it's like a bug coming into a capacitor, it's going to see an electrical discharge. But that was just a stupid probe, just a kind of like refrigerator piece of weight to crash into the surface of Comet Temple 1. And when it did, no water came out. It was just dust. It was just dust and powder. And so there was nothing water, there was no water, there was nothing H2O about it. And so now they're going to bring down an intelligent lander with equipment on it. I wonder if it'll even make it down to the surface. They will be taking pictures of this from a distance. In fact, it'll be interesting to see if the orbiter even lasts very long, because it's going to be involved in the discharge around that comet nucleus, and it could become fatally fried also. Remember that the Giotto probe that went to Comet Halley's was also a European space probe. It went behind Comet Halley, it went in front. It went to the sunward side of Comet Halley, and it took pictures of the nucleus. As soon as it got in front on the sunward side of Comet Halley's nucleus, it was hit by a tremendous electron beam. The electron sensors went off scale, the magnetic field sensors went off scale, and it started to gyrate out of control. And finally, after a while, they were able to get control of it back. But that was one of the unsung events of the Halley's Comet visit by the various spacecraft, that very directly measuring the electron beam that I've talked about on the sunward side of the comet nucleus. Just amazing how they are in absolute complete denial over all of the space science data that has come back from comet nuclei. The other nuclei that they have visited, also hot, dry rocks with no water on them at all. And so there should be no surprise when they get to this one, but watch as they will claim it's a dirty snowball, a fluffy little visitor from beyond, wanderer, etc. So, at any rate, the point is that there's no fanfare that I'm expecting from the Rosetta mission. It did some interesting photography of asteroids that it has a close passed by some asteroids and did send back some valuable data on asteroids. But once again, we are just seeing the ongoing decades and decades of bad science building up a lot of wasted time, a lot of wasted money, a lot of wasted effort, because the space scientists stick with this paradigm of dirty snowball comets and preventing the world from progressing into what I call positive science, understanding that comets are electrical, that they in fact can teach us about the electrical conditions in the solar system, of which we should be harvesting this electrical energy and doing away with coal, nuclear, oil, and natural gas, as burning these as sources of energy, getting onto a natural source of energy. Because just imagine, all of the wind energy eventually is spent. All of that energy goes into something. So if we take some of it, just actually a small piece of it, and use it to our benefit, it's a very natural form of energy. We're not creating heat where there wasn't heat before, which is the case with nuclear, coal, oil, and natural gas. You are taking basically an inert organic material, converting it into energy, heat energy, using some of that, and all of it eventually gets dumped back in the atmosphere as heat energy, and then polluting along the way with chemicals, with nuclear pollution, and destroying our environment. I mean, it's just an absolutely horrific economic model that we are following. Plus, causes tremendous amount of expense in everything we do. Very clearly, the Rosetta mission is nothing more than the continuation of a giant lie that's preventing the society of this world from reaching its full potential. Just want to make a few comments before the end of this show. As most of you know, and also to new listeners, this show is brought to you commercial free. You'll notice there are no interruptions every 5 minutes with commercials about everything under the sun. My webpage, jmccsci.com, I have my books, my water filters, my name brand water filters. I have the Recalendar Sun Star Clock, which has been an amazingly popular item. But go there and learn about them. I'm not going to talk about them on the radio show. Just understand that all of that information, plus about 5 gigabytes, all my radio shows are archived there, all for free. So at any rate, go there, jmccsci.com. That's once again JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. And I'll join me next week as I continue on this vein of positive science, science that helps you live your life better. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.